segue to continue at once with the next musical selection or composition.
Segue to make a transition directly from one section or theme
segue,
to another.
To move smoothly and unhesitatingly from one state, situation, condition, or element to another.
Segue to perform in the manner of the preceding section.
Segue to make a transition from one thing to another smoothly and without interruption.
This is Segue with Dean Aldemaro Romero, a weekly program exploring the lives and work of the people of the College of Arts and Sciences at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville.
Hello, everybody. Dr. Carol Frick was born in Racine, Wisconsin, and raised in San Diego, California. She received two bachelor's degrees, one in fine arts and another in English literature from San Diego State University, a master's in history also from San Diego State University, and a doctorate in history from the University of California at Los Angeles, or UCLA. Today, she is a professor and chair in the Department of Historical Studies at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. Welcome to Segue, Dr. Frick.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here on this very cold day.
Okay. But I'm sure it's going to be a warm conversation.
It will, yes.
Now, you have degrees in different disciplines.
Yes.
And you are a student of the Renaissance.
Yes.
So one wonders, do you have to be a Renaissance person to be able to study the Renaissance?
That's a really good question. You know, it helps to know something about art and literature and philosophy and music, since the Renaissance was really a cultural efflorescence of that time, beginning in probably about 1350. So it was, but I kind of came to it in a roundabout way. You know, I was a pianist and interested in painting, etc. And then I began working, doing volunteer work at museums as a docent. And so my trip to history really came through my involvement in art history initially, and then developed from there. So you don't have to be a Renaissance person, but I think a lot of people who study the Renaissance are interested in cultural production of one kind or another, artistic production. So,
okay. Well, let's talk about the Renaissance. I think I always find funny that we're using a French term to describe something that happened in Italy, because Renaissance means rebirth, but in Italian it's Rinascimento. And it's funny why that happened, why we're using a French term to describe an Italian phenomenon.
That is really interesting. Well, really the father of the Italian Renaissance is Jacob Burckhardt, who's a Swiss from Basel, Swiss Protestant, from Basel, Switzerland, and he was fascinated with everything that was not what he was, which was Northern European and Protestant. So he was fascinated with Catholic Italy, and this was in the 1860s. And he wrote for the first time about that period as being a Renaissance. Michelet had also used the term Renaissance, as they say in French. So that term does not come to be applied to that period of history until very late, until, you know, the last decades of the 19th century. And during the Renaissance, the Renaissance people did not use the term in the same way to apply to this period. They may say there was a rebirth of, a certain style of architecture, or there was a rebirth of the vernacular language, but they wouldn't have said, we are living during the Renaissance. That's a term that historians later apply.
Now, when we're talking about the Renaissance, the most common stereotype is to say, well, it was born in what is known today as Italy. It was in Italy at that time, of course.
Right.
Particularly in Florence.
Yes, in Florence.
Why do you think it happened there?
Well, that is my city of study, Florence. Firenze, mm-hmm. in Italiano. And I think, it's still considered the Renaissance city. So I think because the three major literary lights leading up to the Renaissance, that is Dante and Petrarch and Boccaccio, were all from Florence. And when they alighted their newfound appreciation of pre-Christian civilizations, like of Greece and Rome, which had kind of been lost during the Middle Ages, what Petrarch called the Dark Ages, that they applied it to their lives in a new way, and it was called humanism, and it took some of the focus from just the spiritual realm into a more secular realm and an appreciation for the life here and now rather than just the previous medieval focus on the afterlife. And then was, of course, applied to society in general in the form of civic humanism, which embraced the vita attiva rather than the vita contemplativa of the previous period. So many of the most famous people during the Renaissance were all from Florence. And if you go to Santa Croce today, they're all buried there. Galileo is buried right next to Machiavelli, who's buried right next to Leonardo Bruni. Some of the major people of the period are Florentines.
Do you think that has to do in some way with the fact that Florence, the big people in Florence were the bankers, were the Medicis.
The Medicis.
Who, in a way, created the sense of philanthropy to support the arts just for the sake of it. Do you think it has something to do with that?
Well, you know, that's really interesting. I just finished writing a book review on that today. The idea of magnificence in Florence. Lorenzo de' Medici was called Il Magnifico. And that it was a person's civic duty to give back to the community if they had been blessed with social rank and financial wealth. And that idea of kind of philanthropy, as you said, or a feeling of needing to give back for the good of for the common good rather than just your own aggrandizement was really, and also Florence was really important in Florence. Also, Florence was a republic. You know, there were maybe 2,000 people that were chosen for office, and they were chosen by lot out of a borsa, out of a bag. So it wasn't a duchy, didn't have nobles. They kicked all their nobles out by 1292. So it was a merchant oligarchy, a republic. And there was a government, where they say, quod omnes tangit, where everyone touched it. Mm-hmm. So there's a more modern sense there than in some of the other small little city-states that comprised northern Italy, about 75 of them.
Well, that's interesting because although we always associate Italy with very old history, from dating back to the Roman Empire and all that kind of things, the fact of the matter that Italy as a country didn't begin until the mid-19th century.
I know.
And before that, you have all these little states like Florence and Milano and Venezia and all these other things. And most people don't realize that.
I know. You know, if you take a look at the difference between, say, Italy and Spain, it's so different. Here you have the first large absolutist state in the 16th century that's wildly wealthy and has domains all around the globe. And Ferdinand and Isabella create this huge, giant, wealthy state. It never happens in Italy. Of course, Italy does have the church right in the center of the peninsula. Mm-hmm. And it had the remains of the Roman Empire. That is, all these little city-states, some of which had existed from the time of the Roman Empire. So it really has a different model. And as you say, I mean, it's not unified until 1861, which is relatively late for, you know, a European country.
Not only that, these different states even spoke different languages.
Spoke different language. Till today, you go to Venice, and the gondoliers are speaking Venetian, which sounds as like the buzzing of mosquitoes. I mean, there's all these Zs in Venetian. And, I mean, something like, by the 1890s, something like 2.5% of Italians spoke what we consider modern Italian. So 2.5%. And what is modern Italian? It's Tuscan.
Yes.
It comes from.
Yeah.
Florence. Interesting.
And that shows how the cultural impact in part
absolutely,
of that revolution.
Yeah.
Now, why do you become interested in Renaissance? Because, I mean, let's face it, you were born in Wisconsin, grew up in Southern California, and suddenly you say, wow, the Renaissance. Why? What attracted you to become a Renaissance expert?
And that's really interesting because partly it has to do with my background in art history and really loving some of the artwork of that period, such as Botticelli, Ghirlandaio, Masaccio, Veneziano, Bellini, just many, many artists. However, when I was growing up and I was in college in the 1970s and then grad school in the 1980s, there were no female artists that we know of from the Renaissance, none. And I kept always wondering, what were the women doing? There had to have been women there, but they were not in evidence. Now we know Artemisia Gentileschi was painting and Sofonisba Anguissola was painting. Now we know about Laura Serrani, but we didn't at the time. So my burning question was, what were the women doing? How can I find out? So I started reading and being interested in reading articles and going with new practices in the historical profession. Before, it was all government documents, which that were your primary sources. But by the 1980s, letters started to be admissible, and novels and material culture as artifacts of the past. So I started reading the letters, which took me into Italian and which took me into paleography so I could read the handwriting.
Now, you're a historian, and I was wondering, why was this bias of not considering women as part of the Renaissance? Because, of course, everybody, this is about Leonardo and Michelangelo.
Yes, exactly.
But you never hear about women. What happened there?
As it turns out, probably one of the great high points of cultural history for Europe was probably the nadir for females. That is, as culture became more organized and the Renaissance embraced humanist ideas, the ideals of humanism, that is the ideals of Greece and Rome, became allied to males. So the ideals of magnificence and eloquence and having wonderful rhetorical powers and strength and bravery all became masculine ideas. But what kept in the same way that it had been in the medieval period was the Christian virtues were maintained for women. And there comes to be a split, a social split that's exacerbated by around 1450. So women are supposed to be in the model of Christ. So women are supposed to be modest and obedient and simple and silent and respectful and prudent and all the Christian virtues, whereas men are supposed to be magnificent. A magnificent woman, though, no, not yet.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because to me, one of the big breakthroughs of the Renaissance was the depiction of human beings, how
yes.
it changed. Because before that, basically you have all the paintings were around biblical stories with males being the protagonists and everything like that. But suddenly in the Renaissance, for the first time, you see the depiction not only of women in different roles, but
yes.
even naked women,
yes.
which was a big revolution.
Shocking.
What happened?
Shocking. Well, I mean, the embracing of the ancient civilizations of Greece and Rome, Petrarch was the first person to realize that Roman civilization was based on the earlier Greek civilization. He was the first one to understand that, and with less of a concern about pre-Christian people of history, you know, why should we even care about them because we're all Christians, with less of a concern about that. Some people said, well, you know, if Aristotle had been born when Jesus was born, he would have been a Christian too, and so would Cicero have been a Christian, and Livy would have been a Christian. They all would have been Christians, but Jesus hadn't been born. So as that becomes more tolerated in society, there comes a shift from just a clearly spiritual focus to more of a secular focus. And the value of marriage, for example, the value rather than being a monk, which had been the ideal during the medieval period, to pray for the goods of the souls in a monastery. Now, writers were writing about the fact that it was important to be part of your community, to participate, to be educated, but also to be involved in business and to, you know, endow new chapels and have children and make money so that you could give the money to the church. I mean, before, that was not considered something that was desirable. Usury, the making of interest on loans was not considered desirable. So bankers were really, you know, shunned before the dialogue starts to change in the 15th century. And women all are part of that. But actually one historian had called them sacred dolls, used to display the wealth of their husband with their magnificent clothing.
Pearls and...
And yes, and pearls. And Torquato Tasso even says, women, you shall achieve eloquence by your silence. So it will take a while for females to even start painting. And now, you know, the painters I'm talking about, I mentioned before, Artemisia Gentileschi, that's 16th century. It takes a while. But eventually, as these humanistic ideas filter through society, you don't just see religious art, the Virgin and Child and saints. You see, first of all, the Virgin and Child and saints and pictures of the donors who paid for the painting in the painting. And then the donors get bigger and bigger. And then pretty soon the donors are right in front, the people, the rich people, and it's their portrait. And the biblical scene is behind them in the picture. Still a little biblical scene, until it gets way far behind, and then poof, the biblical scene disappears, and all you have left are the rich people.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing I don't think most people realize is that the way women were seen or were considered at that time was totally different as a woman today. Not only they were not equal, they were not considered in a romantic way, as because romanticism as a moving as an idea is rather recent.
Absolutely.
They were seen as a way to, especially in the upper classes, to create alliances.
Absolutely.
They were like the ones who had to procreate children. There wasn't any romantic view of women.
No, I mean, the only time you saw that was in literature in a little earlier period in France. In Italy, it never really took hold. So that's the courtly love time period in the courts of southern France, Aquitaine, etc. Women were very valuable to families because they could marry into another family and make family alliances. So if you wanted to have a political faction, women were very useful in building that faction. Women of the upper class, however, usually married down, and men married up. So the nouveau riche men would marry up to a slightly impoverished, more noble family, a girl of that family. And men in general were 15 years older than their wives.
Yeah.
And especially valuable was a girl who came with seven brothers. Then you had all new in-laws who were younger than you, all these other men who then, this is what the Medici did, could all be branch managers of your banks all over Europe. And the Tornabuoni family that married into the Medicis, that's just what they did. So women were valuable, but they weren't considered, you know, our idea of romantic love just was not what marriage was about, at least.
Yeah. Yeah.
It existed in poetry.
Now, you have been a very prolific author of literature on the Renaissance, and here are some of the most recent of your publications that the people who are actually watching this through our webcam can see on the website of the College of Arts and Sciences. And, for example, you have this chapter titled Picture Perfect Female Performance and Social Liminality in the Florentine Renaissance City. What is this all about?
Yeah, well, Picture Perfect is what we were just mentioning. That is, a woman would get dressed to the nines. And what the nines meant is that your wedding train was 9 feet long. They don't say feet, they'd say braccia in Italian. Mm-hmm. Dressed to the nines, but you were, and so you were to be paraded as a, like a trophy wife, displaying your husband's wealth, but you were not supposed to say anything in public. So social liminality means that in public, women were at the limbs or the thresholds, the borders of society. Now, at home, though, women ruled the roost.
Different story.
the dona governo. It was a totally different story. But out in public, excluded from all the institutions of public. So you couldn't be a high church prelate if you were a woman. You still can't. And of course, the only Christian religion was Roman Catholicism, because this is pre-Martin Luther. You couldn't be in the university system until you were. We were in the 1700s. No women are educated. There was very little for you to do socially. You couldn't be in politics.
So they were basically treated as a property that you traded in many ways because of social advantage.
And I'll tell you, the women that had it the roughest were little girls from poor families who were beautiful because they could be taken advantage of. They didn't have any protection. And it was difficult, a girl from poor family. People have always said, you know, you had three options if you were a woman in the Renaissance. You could be a wife, a prostitute, or a nun.
Okay. I'm sure many people today wouldn't like only those three options.
No.
Now, you mentioned a few minutes ago about the dressing of the
yes.
people and all that kind of things. And you have actually published a book titled Dressed Renaissance Florence.
Yes.
What can we learn from looking at the way people dress during the Renaissance?
Well, first of all, you have to realize, and I was really the first person that discovered this, 40% of a family's wealth was in their clothing. I mean, that was their consumer good. You couldn't buy a Lexus or a Rolex. I mean, there weren't things to buy. We didn't have the kind of material culture we have today. So everything was in their clothes. You could tell by the shade of red of their cloak how much it costs. I mean, it was all about clothes. That's how you presented yourself to the world. And clothing was severely structured. Sumptuary legislation, controlling consumption, was huge. Something like 200 different laws were passed in the city of Florence, just trying to control what people wore so that you didn't mix up the classes, because there was class mm-hmm. movement available. So if you were, you know, of a certain class, you could wear four rings. Or if you were a little lower, that you could wear three rings. Or you could wear a certain kind of, how many buttons you could wear, what colors you could wear. You could read somebody immediately, kind of like you can now. But it was even more intense then.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Now, you also teach about the Renaissance.
Yes.
What do you tell your students to convince them that they need to understand the Renaissance, that they need to learn about that period of time?
Well, some people have argued that the Renaissance is when modern consciousness was born, because it's the first time when it's cool to be famous. It's the first time someone says, never let them see you sweat. Just be cool. It's the first time someone says the ends justify the means, and whatever that means. It doesn't matter how you really are. It matters how you appear to be. All these are new ideas that in the medieval period would have been considered heretical, ideas would have been considered un-Christian, unthinkable. But in the Renaissance, slowly but surely, our modern way of thinking, the idea of individualism as well. In the medieval period, it was all about your family. I mean, no artist would have signed a painting in the medieval period. You would be going to hell. It was hubris nemesis. In the Renaissance, here's people signing. Here's artists painting themselves into the pictures. Who they think they are. It was the very first time where individualism started to liberate people from their family group. It will take hundreds of years until we get to radical individualism, mm-hmm. but it's the beginnings also of participatory government.
Now, you also take students to Italy.
Yes, I do.
And most of these students probably never been outside the United States.
Or have never been on a plane.
Never been on a plane, never seen the ocean.
Never seen the ocean.
What kind of transformative experience it is for them to travel this, so many, many miles to a totally different country, to a totally different culture, and in a way to a totally different period of history?
Yes. They just can't stop smiling. You know, normally students sometimes are late to class. Well, when we go to Italy, they have to be, we're on it 24/7. So they have to be ready to go, up and ready to go, and having had breakfast at 9 a.m. And they're always early because they can't wait to see what we're going to be doing the next day. Because the first day we go to Rome, the first thing we're at the Vatican, and we meet the Pope. Benedict the 16th now. And then a little bit later in the day, we're at the Roman Colosseum, where they, you know, had the Christians and the lions, and there's elevators for the elephants. Yeah. And we go and stand in the patio area of Caesar Augustus's house up on the Capitoline Hill. And from there you can see the Hard Rock Cafe and the American Embassy. You know, and then go have a pizza.
Kind of a cultural shock.
It is a cultural shock, but in a really amazing way. What I find is that many of my students go back to Europe the next year because it's just it's expanded the horizons.
Well, now you mentioned pizza. Most people don't know that pizza in Italia doesn't look like a pizza in America.
No, it doesn't at all. Not at all. Yeah, sorry, quite as much cheese.
Well, thank you very much to Dr. Carol Frick of the Department of Historical Studies at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville, with whom we have had this very interesting conversation about Renaissance that we could be going on and on and on. And next week.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Next week, we're going to have Dr. Isaac Blankson, who is a chair and professor of the Department of Speech Communication in our studio, who will be talking about the challenges of human communications around the world. So stay tuned.
This has been Segway with Dean Aldemaro Romero, a production of the Department of Mass Communications at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. All rights reserved, 2013.